Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It is almost Christmas Eve. Hectic, probably, but also prone to joy, cheer, sugar plum fairies, and carols. On the radio, in the streets, maybe in a flash mob at the mall these days, Christmas carols, centuries old, are all around us. Their history is rich, sometimes mysterious. Pagan dances, beggars chants, carols for God, carols for ale. This hour on Point, we're listening and learning the history of the Christmas carol. You can join the conversation. Do the carols speak to you? Do you carol? Where? When? What's your favorite? And do you know its history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Northfield, New Jersey, is Ronald Clancy. He spent his life researching the stories behind the carols, creator of ChristmasClassics.com and author of, among others, Best Loved Christmas Carols, the stories behind 25 Yuletide favorites. Ronald Clancy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. I appreciate it.
And with us from Sheffield, England, is Ian Russell, professor of music and director of the Elphinstone Institute at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, a caroler himself and director of the Festival of Village Carols. His field recordings of caroling are archived at the British Library Sound Archive and the Smithsonian Institute. His compilation of carolers from around England is English Village Carols. Ian Russell, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Ian, just begin to take us in. Where do Christmas carols come from?
Well, they come from the fact that people wanted to celebrate in their own way the feast of Christmas. And this goes back certainly to the time of the Romans, but we don't really have so much documentary evidence from this period. The first real evidence is from the medieval period, and certainly they were associated with celebrating, with feasting, with forgetting the drudgery of everyday living, and for letting the hair down, I think.
So if when you think of the carols that are best known and widely sung, are most of them, are they built on songs that have been around even from pre-Christian eras, or are they all products of Christian composition, or are they built on older songs, Ian?
Well, the origins of the carols, in some cases, we know exactly where they came from. In other cases, we're not really sure at all. Something like, for example, Hark the Herald, we know Charles Wesley was behind the text of that. But something like, for example, the First Noel, which we just heard in the intro there, we've no idea where that the particular text came from. It was somewhere in Cornwall. It was published in the 1820s and 30s for the first time. It had probably been on the go for 100 years before that. And when it was published, the editors changed the words a little bit, I think, to make it more appealing to their readership. And that's probably the form that we have it in now.
We heard it sung there by the Christmas Revels out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. A beautiful, beautiful song. As you say, it goes way back, but some go back even further. Let's keep it right in our ears. Let's hear another. Here's Deck the Halls. This is just last month, nearly 300 students and carolers from the University of Minnesota School of Music paid a visit to a neighboring student lounge in the School of Management there for a what's today called a flash mob rendition of a 16th century Welsh carol, Deck the Halls.
What are we gonna deck? Bells of holly, deck the halls with bells of holly, fa la 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 la,
right up to date with a flash mob version arranged there by our Francisco Nunez and Jim Papoulos. Ronald Clancy, you hear there just how adaptable the Christmas Carol is. That's a quite contemporary rendition suddenly pouring forth from 300 students in Minnesota.
It's ironic, but I just saw that the other day on, I believe it was on YouTube. Somebody sent it to me, and I thought it was rather fascinating the way they did Deck the Halls.
Tell us about the origin of the word itself. Carol comes from a French word, not for song, but for dance, I think, Ronald.
The word Deck the Halls is essentially familiar. It's a Welsh carol, and the melody was found in a 1784 song collection titled Musical and Poetical Relics of the Welsh Bards. But it's also associated with, I guess, a French carol called Nos Galants, meaning the New Year's Eve. And in fact, the Mozart, the great Austrian composer, used the melody for one of his compositions.
Relics of the Bards. It doesn't sound like a relic in the flash mob rendition right there. Ian, help us here on the origin of carol, Ian, and the etymology of this word. It goes more to dance and flute and French and Greek and on back, Ian.
Yes, I certainly believe that the word was used for a form of celebration of singing in which people not only sang words and told a story, but they also moved around as they sang. And this was a style of performing that existed in ballad singing. For example, in the Pharaohs, it's still practiced. What I don't think is perhaps true to the point that it was very energetic dancing. I don't know if you've ever tried doing energetic dancing and singing at the same time.
Maybe, yeah.
I think it's probably pretty difficult. So yes, I certainly feel that it was about doing things in the round, and that's where the word carol comes from. But of course, words change their meaning quite dramatically over the centuries.
And languages change as well. Here's an early version of O Come Emmanuel, Beni Beni Emmanuel, nearly 1,000 years old, here performed by the Christendom College Choir and School of Gregoriana from Front Royal, Virginia. There, a 12th century Advent hymn that would grow into the carol, now called O Come, Emmanuel. We're talking about Christmas carols and caroling. Do you do it? Do they speak to you even now, maybe 1,000 or more years after they were first sung? Let's bring our listeners in. Julie in Bell Buckle, Tennessee. Julie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, Julie.
I just wanted to say I live in a real small town of about 450, and our good friend organizes a caroling party every year. We just went caroling last night and had a wonderful time.
Do you bring the kids along? Do you stand at the front door and do it?
We do. Everybody's kids come. We have treats. She makes mulled cider and hot chocolate and all kinds of treats when we're done. But we wear Santa hats and go door to door, and it's just wonderful.
Are you welcome, Julie? Are people happy to hear you show up with your song?
Yeah. Well, we go to houses where we know people, so, you know, they don't really expect us, and a lot of times they'll, you know, be in their nightgowns or whatever, but, you know, they'll come to the door, and you know, it's because somebody's like, oh, well, let's visit so-and-so, you know, and it might be a retiree who, you know, it's really happy for the, you know, everybody's happy to see us.
And do the kids like it, or do they think it's too old-fashioned, Julie?
No, they love it. They love it.
Out and on the street, that has a long tradition as well, not least from wassailing. Julie, thanks for calling. When ale took people to the streets in song.
Singing was ale, was ale, was ale, and Johnny come to our jolly was ale.
I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Pockets of money and a cellar of beer.
For singing was ale, was ale, was ale, and Johnny come to our jolly Wassail.
Ian Russell, this is right in your backyard. What about the tradition of going door to door? Was it literally for a cup of ale?
In the case of the wassailers, they would carry with them a wassail cup or a wassail bowl, and they would invite the householders to have a sip out of their cup. But I reckon they also hoped that the householders would top it up as well. And maybe there would be other goodies being offered, as well as perhaps a donation of some money. The thing about the wassailing tradition was that it was the poor people of a community, of a parish, of a district, going round often the richer homes, the farms, the people who had well-lined pockets. And it was this negotiation between different parts of the community that the license of the 12 days of Christmas brought. And wassailing was very much a Twelfth Night a custom.
A little redistribution of wealth happening there, right in those exchanges maybe, at the door of the finer house. And there it is behind us, wassailing on and on. And that tradition is still very much alive in Bellbuckle, Tennessee, as Julie tells us, and far beyond as well. Ian Russell, stand by in Sheffield, England. Ronald Clancy, it's great to have you both with us. We're talking this hour about the history of the Christmas carol, from pagan days and drinking halls to high church and holiness. Christmas carols all over. Listeners, you can join us. Tis the season, almost Christmas Eve. What do you love to sing? What takes you back, carries you away, lights up Christmas for you in song? Do you know the histories of these songs in England, in France, in Appalachia, we'll hear? Do you know their roots in pre-Christian celebration, even in wassailing, in the church and out of it? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. On the eve of Christmas Eve, we're talking this hour about the history of the Christmas carol, from pagan days and drinking halls to high church and holiness, Christmas carols all over, with Ian Russell, who joins us from Sheffield, England today, a caroler himself, ethnomusicologist, director of the Elphinstone Institute at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, author of English Village Carols, and with us from Northfield, New Jersey, Ronald Clancy, studied carols inside and out, particularly American, but all over, author of Sacred Christmas Music and Best Loved Christmas Carols. You can join the conversation as well. Do you carol? Where? When? For whom? What's your big crowd pleaser? Are you a flash mob caroler? Been surprised by one in the food court lately? Tell us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What is it about these songs that make them so persistent? Behind us, of course, right here, Merry Christmas, as in, we wish you a... Let's get a caller, Gail in Lexington, Kentucky. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to share, a few years ago when I was working two jobs, one of the jobs was at Walmart, and I was working the Christmas Eve shift, and I came home exhausted, bad day, and some teenagers came to my door and sang a hip-hop version of Jingle Bells, and it made my evening. And in our neighborhood, periodically we will hear people walking down the street doing carols. They don't come to the door. They just walk down the street. So we open the door now and we wave at our neighbors. And it's just great. It started with some teenagers doing it a few years ago, and now we have neighbors that go out some days, a few days before Christmas, and some nights on Christmas Eve.
Gail, I love that story. Home from a Christmas Eve night shift at Walmart and a little caroling, hip-hop Jingle Bells at your front door lifted your spirits.
Oh, it did. It made it feel like Christmas again.
I love it. Thank you so much. Ronald Clancy, what is it about the structure of these songs, their origins, the way they're presented, something intrinsic to them that makes them so potent for those who adopt them as part of their culture, artistic life?
Well, I think a lot of songs that are folks' favorites are those that they hear when they're children, and I've been predisposed pretty much to the traditional carols, and it's very interesting, by the way, listening to Eon from Sheffield. Of course, James Montgomery wrote a wonderful carol from Sheffield. And but a lot of these carols, as Eon mentioned earlier, we do not know actually who the composers are. However, this carol, for instance, We Wish You a Merry Christmas, has a very energetic quality to it, very cheerful, and it's a kind of song that I think should lift the spirits of a lot of folks out there who love especially traditional carols.
Ian Russell, you're an ethnomusicologist. Is there something in the structure of the music itself that's in common to these? Or is it simply that these are songs heard in childhood and they retain that resonance of something old and beloved?
Well, the example we just heard, Merry Christmas, was performed all round the Sheffield area, and particularly associated with a group of carolers who were so proficient at their art, they were known as the Big Set. And they had fiddles and cellos, double basses, they sang in parts. And what characterised the carols for them were being able to perform like this, and also the vigour of the performance. Carols, these sort of carols were not pretty. They were robustious, they were full-blooded, they were vigorous, and people really sort of gave them their all. And in some ways, to me, this is what people enjoy about carol singing. It's not so much being part of the most extraordinary musical aesthetic experience. Mm-hmm. Is far more about just being able to join in and give, and it doesn't matter if you're a fine singer or a wonderful player of an instrument, you can join in.
And usually with melodies that just about anybody can carry if they join. God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, we'll play a bit from here all the way back from the 16th century. Became especially popular after it was used in Charles Dickens, or referenced in Charles Dickens' 1843 story, A Christmas Carol.
God rest you merry, gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born this Christmas day to save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray. And it's tidings of comfort and joy. Comfort and joy.
Let's take a call. Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, Merry Christmas, Tom.
Thank you.
My point was that there's some controversy, I understand, that the origins of the Christmas carols are so old, and they, you know, they preceded the birth of Christ, and when the Catholic Church then came in and wanted to, take over. Well, not take over, but they wanted to
organize. You know, I think is the word.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And introduce Christianity into the old world. Then they had no choice but to start off with what was available at the time, and that was the carols that folks may have sung for different reasons, because it was pre-Christian times. And so then, I wish the controversy could die away and us enjoy them as they're meant to be today.
Well, Beth, I appreciate your call there. Ian, what about the church and carols? Has it always, in England, for example, has it always welcomed carols, or were they seen as something that should be done outside of the actual church setting in history, Ian?
Well, the Puritans certainly didn't welcome them. They banned them. So that's the 17th century. And they were reintroduced after, with the restoration of the monarchy. And then gradually, they were encouraged by the church. And during the early parts of the 18th century, late in the 18th century, singing was encouraged, and the singing of carols, and many local people contributed to this. Tailors, weavers, shoemakers, blacksmiths, they wrote the music. They had the words. The words were often, well, they were printed on broadsides and sold for a penny by chapmen or in chapbooks. But they wrote the music, and they didn't have training. They were tremendously creative people. Some of the music probably wasn't very exciting and rather repetitive, but the stuff that's come down to us today, today is absolutely extraordinary. It's a delight. And these carols became so wonderfully established, but the church didn't like it. The church, I don't know if you've ever heard the term facing the music.
Yes.
In church, the whole congregation turned away from the priest and faced the music because the music was up in a gallery. And the authorities of the church did not like this. They did not like it. And they, along with several other reforms, many other reforms to do with architecture and to do with the order of service and all sorts of things, this singing had to go. And it was no problem to many of the singers for the carols, because the carols had never been wholly part of church. They'd always been betwixt and between. They were neither sacred nor secular. They were both. And they operated without the license of the church. And that was hugely important to their longevity.
And so they would take it straight out of the church and it would survive in the streets and door to door.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they would take the instruments with them, because the reformists, who were known as Tractarians or the Oxford movement, and we're talking about 1850 to about 1860, 1815 to 1860, they replaced all the musicians with an organ. One organ instead of maybe six or eight musicians.
A little easier to keep a handle on, maybe a little easier to gather. It's interesting, we've got all kinds of response here. Doug says, I love singing Christmas carols. They're written so beautifully, even though I'm an atheist, he writes on Twitter. NJ writes online a kind of counterpoint, and she's quoting Joni Mitchell here, and not necessarily in ecstatic praise at all. Joni Mitchell's song with It's Coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees, they're putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. And some people may have that response. Question here from listener Alan Ronald Clancy about Good King Wenceslas. He says, fun fact, Good King Wenceslas, of course the carol by the same name, was known in medieval Bohemia as Duke Václav. What do you know about the history of that particular carol, Ronald Clancy?
Well, the carol, as we know it, the English a version of the carol is actually composed by Reverend John Mason Neal, a wonderful Anglican priest. And he actually took a 13th, 14th century tune from a Latin spring song. And it was not a translation of that text. It's merely his own words he added to that tune. And he chose Good King Wenceslas as a good role model for children. And he was familiar with the Duke of Bohemia, who was assassinated. And he was the Duke was one who was, you know, who helped establish Christianity in Bohemia at the time, but also one who supported poor people and, you know, a lot of charitable causes. But the nobility did not particularly appreciate that, and as a result of that, assassinated him.
Wow!
But the Reverend John Mason Neal, again a wonderful person, took Good King Wenceslas as a good role model for children, and thus that's why he wrote that particular carol.
And lives on in song, along with the very, very common beseeching or prompt in Christmas carols to do good, to take care of our fellow men and women. Let's go to Daryl in Glen Rock, Pennsylvania. Daryl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Yes, best wishes from Glen Rock, Pennsylvania to everyone, and especially to Ian Russell in Sheffield.
Are you acquainted with one another, Daryl?
Yes, we are. We are the Glen Rock Carolers that sang on the festival with Ian Russell in 2002, and we're going over again and singing in 2012.
Oh, well, that's fantastic, and how good to have you. This is terrific. We actually have some of your music here, Glen Rock Carolers, way out in Glen Rock, Pennsylvania. Stick with us, Daryl. Let's let everybody hear. This is While Shepherds Watch. This is all of you in 2008, textured by, this is off of a Handel song. Let's listen. All right, the Glen Rock Carolers with While Shepherds Watched. Now, Daryl, you're just outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. This isn't a studio recording, obviously. You're out in the town square. Tell us about the setting and what's going on there, Daryl.
The setting is we are getting ready to go out for the 164th night since 1848, and we walk through the streets of Glen Rock from midnight until 7 a.m. Christmas morning,
oh,
singing
goodness.
The old English carols.
That is unbelievable. How about your reception by the town over all those years? Has it grown warmer, or do they throw candy canes at you trying to make you shut up?
Oh, my, no. It's grown warmer through the years. I've never been cold on Christmas Eve.
Wow, that's terrific. Ian, I guess you've met this group from Pennsylvania, Ian Russell.
Yes, they're a most wonderful band of carolers, and band is the correct word for such a group, because band just didn't refer to instruments, it refers to singers. And they, the Glen Rock carolers, have the essence of Christmas that was true in Derbyshire and Yorkshire and Cheshire and all places round Sheffield. They would start their Christmas celebrations with Christians awake at the stroke of midnight before visiting the community, the farms, and going out across the fields and so on under the stars.
Daryl, we wish you very good caroling this year with the Glen Rock Singers there, and thanks so much for making the connection with us today. Lee in Charleston, thank you, Daryl. Lee in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on the air, Lee.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My memory is, it's not one necessarily of the caroling out in the street. It was going to the Christmas service with my family, my parents and my siblings, and listening as the choir director's wife would belt out O Holy Night in a high soprano, and we would squirm. We hated it. We would start laughing. Now that I'm older, though, it's my favorite song by far, and it reminds me of my Christmases with my parents. And it's one that I'll belt out in the car whenever it comes on, and I'm happy to say my kids are squirming just as much.
That's good. It's a great memory, Lee. Mercy to your children, but they may grow up to enjoy it just as much as you do now. Ronald Clancy, there's O Holy Night is the favorite of our caller, Lee. And, of course, many love that, and it makes real demands on a voice by the time you get to those high notes.
Well, actually, that has a wonderful history, O Holy Night. It was actually written in 1847. By a French fellow by the name of Placide Capot, and he asked a friend of his who was Jewish to actually write the music for his lyrics. And initially, the churchgoers in France loved the song, but the church had some problems with it. It may have to do with Capot's socialist leanings, as well as being a friend of a Jewish composer, Adolf Adam. What was interesting is that the translation of the carol, which we know as O Holy Night, the French carol's name was Cantique de Noël or Minuit Chrétien, but the O Holy Night translation was by John Sullivan Dwight, a Unitarian minister who actually used to get stage fright giving sermons to his congregation. As a result of that, he retired from the ministry. But he actually wrote the English translation for O Holy Night, as well as for other hymns and carols from Europe, which he was quite fond of. But what's also interesting about O Holy Night, it is the first carol ever heard on the radio. On the Christmas Eve in 1906, ships at sea heard a fellow playing on a violin, O Holy Night.
That is amazing. You're going right back to the very, very earliest days of radio there. And on it was, 1906, O Holy Night. And I love the sort of braided history of that composition and how it's come across in translation. Ian Russell, translation is a big part, both language translation, cultural translation of these carols. Many of them shift and change a little bit as they move between countries, cultures, Ian.
Yes, there's a bit of a backstory going on here. If you remember earlier, I mentioned how the carols, many of them, were driven out of the churches along with the bands who performed them and the instrumentalists. Well, this created a vacuum, and by about 1850s and 60s, they were very much aware of not having anything to sing at Christmas, hardly. And so they looked to, this is the churches in England, they looked to Germany, to France, they looked in medieval manuscript, and they created new carols themselves, particularly, for example, O Little Town of Bethlehem or Once in Royal David's City, to fill this vacuum in church.
It's a great story and music beloved by many. Here's Hark the Herald Angels Sing. This is the St. Herman Youth Conference Carolers. Ian Russell in Sheffield, England, stand by. And Ron Clancy, it's great to have you with us as well. We're talking about the history of the Christmas Carol. Listeners, you can join us. What's your favorite? What's your story? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the history of the Christmas Carol, from pagan days and drinking halls to high church and holiness, and behind us right here to the Appalachian Mountains of the United States, where folklorists found this carol being sung in North Carolina, in this case, and it made its way into many songbooks of Christmas carols. Ronald Clancy joins us today. He's author of Sacred Christmas Music and Best Loved Christmas Carols. Ian Russell joins us, caroler, ethnomusicologist, director of the Elphinstone Institute at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, author of English Village Carols. You can join us as well. Are you a flash mob caroler? Been surprised by one in a food court lately? Tell us about it. Could we sing our way to peace on earth? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Ronald Clancy, tell us about the remarkable story of this I Wonder As I Wander we've just heard.
I think this is one of America's great folk carols. It was actually discovered in the early 1930s by John Jacob Niles. He was traveling through Appalachia, which he often did, to discover new folk carols sung by the hill folk. And he was actually in this town called Murphy, North Carolina. And there was this itinerant revivalist family that was squatting in a town square there. And the folks there, the mayor and so forth, felt that these folks had have to go. They're hanging their laundry on the fountain in the middle of the square, making a nuisance of themselves. And so the father of the revivalist family, the minister, asked if he could have one more meeting to raise enough funds to get gas so they could run, go out of town.
Yeah.
And during that revival meeting, they had their daughter sing this song, which had very few lyrics to it, but the melody was fantastic. And in attendance was John Jacob Niles. He'd asked the girl afterwards if she would sing the song again for him, and for each time that she did, he would pay her 25 cents. She sang the song 8 times, he wrote down as much as he could in his own musical shorthand, and 2 years later, he published I Wonder As I Wonder by adding on additional lyrics.
It's such a wonderfully haunting melody. How do you think, Ronald, that what does it take to bring a song into the world of carols? I mean, it is now the part of many collections of carols, and it's, as you say, less than a century old, at least as far as we know. What does it take to make a song become included in the sort of pantheon of carols?
Well, if you listen to the lyrics of this song, and just like some of my favorite carols, by the way, are the 16th, 17th English carols, there's a certain simplicity to the lyrics that resonates with ordinary folks. They're not highfalutin lyrics, but they really get to the heart of the matter with respect to, in this case, honoring Jesus Christ. And again, it's folk carols are really wonderful because there's very little pretense to them. They just have this wonderful, honest feel to them, and people gravitate to them. And again, I think this I Wonder is just a tremendous carol.
Ian Russell, so many have come across the Atlantic to us. Has this come back to you in England, I Wonder As I Wander, or does this remain a particularly American carol?
No, there are arrangements in the UK of that same carol. In fact, I was in our local church for the carol service last Sunday evening, and it was performed there, an arrangement by John Rutter.
Here's a wonderful, different direction entirely from that plaintive, haunting melody, the very rich and robust rendition of Go Tell It on the Mountain. This is St. Peter's Gospel Choir from New Orleans with the great spiritual compiled in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Let's listen. Just fantastic. New Orleans St. Peter's Gospel Choir recorded in 2006. Ronald Clancy, that is pretty terrific. We do a lot of caroling in my house, and I have to say, this is one song we really rock out on. And they clearly take it somewhere really energetic and beautiful. The spiritual, Negro spiritual kind of tradition here in caroling, Ronald.
Oh, yes. Go Tell It on the Mountain is, of course, one of the most popular, as well as Mary Had a Baby. But it was interesting, as you said earlier, this is kind of an anonymous 19th, early 19th century lyrics, but essentially was made popular through the work of the Frederick Jerome Works family and John Wesley Works, one of whom actually went to Fisk University in Tennessee. And just Fisk University, of course, is well noted for its the Fisk Jubilee Singers, which made the spiritual, you know, a popular art form. And they were quite famous for, you know, touring, especially in Europe. They even made a recital in front of Queen Victoria. Essentially, they did that to raise money for Fisk University, which is for African Americans, which was established right after the Civil War for the education of black slaves. But the Fisk University was having a tough time financially, and the Fisk Jubilee Singers helped to essentially raise funds for the university. But getting to this, again, the carol itself is one of hope. It does have a lot of energy to it, and it actually is one that essentially the theme of Christmas was to represent it for slaves, this idea that there's freedom with the coming of Christ. And that's why it resonates so well with them.
It's interesting, all kinds of responses online here. Robert writes, "Bah, humbug, any idiot knows that the great mystery cannot be put into words." Well, maybe, but when you hear it sung with that much verb, there's something mysterious and wonderful there. Patty in Montpelier, Vermont. Patty, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your story, Patty?
Well, this is a distinctly unsacred story, but many years ago, a few of us got together, and we live in a very rural area here, and we went caroling around to all of the farms in our neighborhood at night and sang to the animals.
And how did they respond to your carols?
Well, the cows, this one farm that we went to, the dairy cows all ran to the other side of the paddock, and there was like flying bits of ice and snow and mud and stuff. And they were really scared. And another place we went to, the sheep really dug it. They all came over and stuck their faces into the fence. And it was really, really cold. And so I think we warmed them up.
The middle of a winter's night and a caroling party, caroling to the livestock. That's a great story, Patty. I love it. I'm not sure what to make, what it says about your singing, but I'm glad some of them came over to listen. Pete, thanks for calling. Peter in Providence, Rhode Island. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Great, great show. Thank you. For the last 20 years, my wife and I and some close friends, who some of whom sing in our church choir, have been singing in a caroling group we call the Voices of Christmas. We get all dressed up in Victorian garb.
Wow.
And we go to nursing homes. We sing at the mansions in Newport. We sing in restaurants for free food. We just got done last night with our 19th gig. We start actually before Christmas. We start before Thanksgiving, and we're out almost every night of the week going somewhere. But the most cherished moments are going into the nursing homes and Alzheimer's units and singing for the people there and really seeing them be moved. And it really gives us so much back to do that, that by the time Christmas gets here, we're very clear that we've helped generate the spirit of Christmas.
Peter, what do you see when you go into the nursing home and you're singing to people who maybe it's a long time since they've been with singing with their family or out and able to do what you're doing there? What do you see in their faces?
Yeah, it's tough because emotionally, some of them will be very moved, and some of them actually come up and sing with us. Some of them, it's all over the lot, but it is. And one of the things we love to do, especially in the nursing homes, is when we're done singing, we work the crowd. We go out and really shake people's hands, and it you can't not be moved by that because people are so grateful. I've had my hand kissed many, many times by people just because they love having that experience, and it's filled with memories, and it's bittersweet for them, I'm sure. But it's a wonderful thing that we give to them, but they give back to us because it really enriches our experience of Christmas and just the whole, you really get clear that Christmas is so much more than the presents under the tree. It's all about touching people and showing love to people. And of course, Christmas is such a wonderful excuse to do that. And we always say, well, why couldn't we do that all year?
Yeah.
It's really true.
Good on you, Peter. I think you're onto the heart of it. And keep it up. And we picture you in all of your Victorian garb there. I've got a online here from Bastianini. He says, I learned Christmas carols in public elementary school in the 50s. And writes, I'm a huge supporter of the separation of church and state, but I have to cop to happy memories of those elementary school Christmas pageants. But it's interesting, there's a whole thread, at least within the American genre of Christmas carol, that is not necessarily sacred. Some of the most beloved and beautiful that often get sung in those same settings, really not to do with the sacred side of the story at all. Among the most famous and beloved, well, here's one written by one of the great, great American composers, Irving Berlin, Jewish composer, the fantastic White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops listen and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
White Christmas from the great Irving Berlin. Ronald Clancy, here's this sort of secular face of Christmas caroling in this country. Absolutely beloved, but it's to do with snow and bells, and this isn't necessarily about a manger or a savior. Ronald?
Yes, I'm here.
It's interesting and maybe particularly American to see this thread in the fabric.
Actually, from the early 1930s, a lot of the Christmas songs coming from America were less religious. And the White Christmas, of course, is probably the most famous of them all. And Irving Berlin, of course, was the composer of both the words as well as the music. He actually wrote this 2 years prior to the movie Holiday Inn. The movie folks did not want him releasing the song prior to the premiere of the movie, and it was 1942 when the movie came out. But he was also a good friend of Bing Crosby, who actually sang the song, and Irving Berlin used to make a nuisance of himself on the set as the movie was being made. And in fact, the folks there were hoping that he would just, you know, excuse himself while they made the movie. Later years, when he was very old, when he lived in 17th Beekman Place in New York, which was his home for 42 years prior to his death, which is now, by the way, the Luxembourg Consulate in New York, the United Nations, folks for years used to come to his home and actually sing carols outside of his home, including White Christmas.
That's a beautiful story. Boy, if Irving Berlin's a nuisance, I'll take a nuisance anytime. That's wonderful.
Yeah, he's fantastic songwriter.
Karen writes here, this show brings back so many memories. Catholic school, when all the classes would gather in the halls of the old two-story school and sing as we lit the Advent wreath, O come, O come, Emmanuel. I can't hear the song without getting a tear in my eye, she writes. Also singing Polish carols with all the slightly tipsy, okay, very tipsy, she writes, uncles on Christmas Eve, the only time you saw them all dressed up. There's something magical about carols. Jeanette in Wakefield, Rhode Island. Jeanette, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We've been going caroling through our neighborhood for about almost 30 years, and we always have at least one or two Jewish families who come with us. And the twist that we put on the caroling is that we also take cookie plates that everyone has made homemade cookies and contributed to, and we send the youngest child that's with us up to the door with the cookies while we're singing. And we've been doing this so long that some of the kids who come with us now are in their 20s, and they were babies when they first came with us. So I'm sure that this whole caroling in Wakefield is going to carry on.
Jeanette, we're so glad to hear you're doing it and to hear that it's got so many threads meeting there. So many traditions in this country and around the world, and love to them all here right now. People, you know, with wonderful experiences, lighting their menorahs on these very same nights that Christmas is going on. But when it comes together, it's terrific. Ian Russell, alas, we're going to go out with Silent Night. There's the story of, in World War I, of this being sung across the trenches. Is it a true story, Ian?
I can't see any reason to doubt it for a minute. People saw Christmas as a time that had a magic, and so different things were possible. Christmas transformed people and transformed occasions and brought out the very best in people, and that's exactly what I can imagine would have happened across the trenches. Just as they supposedly had football matches on Christmas Day as well, and that's, I'm sure that's true too.
For transformation and for the best in people, we're all grateful for that. Anything that brings it on can feel pretty good, especially this time of year. Ian Russell at the Elphinstone Institute at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ian.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ronald Clancy, author of Best Loved Christmas Carols, the stories behind 25 Yuletide favorites. Ronald Clancy, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you, Tom, for having me on. And thank you to all your folks who call in, all those carolers out there as well.
Wonderful holidays, peace, and joy to all. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.